Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later in the program, we're going to be speaking to Shelley Hirsch. She's a vocalist, composer, and interdisciplinary artist. Right now, I would like to welcome, joining us by phone, Carl Glickman. He is the editor of the book, Those Who Dared, Five Visionaries Who Changed American Education. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you very much, Mary. It's a pleasure to be with you right now.
It's great to have you. You have assembled in this book the writings of five educators talking about their experiences and their philosophies of teaching. How did you choose these particular five?
Well, these five are legendary in education circles. I mean, they've had a whole career in creating schools across the country that are far different from what most schools are. And it was my pleasure that they're a generation older than I am. And I was doing work with schools in Georgia and throughout the South. And there'd be many times that I would share and we would collaborate together. And I just thought it was such a treasure to ask them to write about the human side of their life, their career, how they made the choices that they did, so that there would be a legacy that could be left. So basically, that's how I identified these particular five. I mean, they're giants in the field of education. They're not the only giants, but what's different about them is how they got into education. How they stayed with a new vision of what education should be for all students and what they were actually able to accomplish working with schools directly over many, many years. I mean, they've had a major impact in thousands of schools throughout the United States.
There's a couple of themes that run throughout the writings of these different people, and one of them is that schools with predominantly African-American students have been, as Henry Levin put it, one of the writers in the book, these schools are often repressive and punitive and generally not conducive to learning. What are some of the ways in which the writers of your book have understood and analyzed the situation and addressed the real racial differential that is found in these black schools?
Well, I think it is race, but it's also ethnicity and it also is class. And so if you look at high poverty schools for predominantly white children or high poverty schools for black students, you find some of the same conditions. Is what you find is a very boring, passive control and authority climate in these schools, where students are expected to just repeat back what the teacher wants them to repeat back. And I'm not overstating it, particularly today's age with all the requirements that have been pushed down on schools, and where testing is so prominent that the whole onus of what the school does and what classroom teachers are controlled to do is to teach to test. And so what you get is a very, very boring place where there's not a lot of liveliness or spirit. And so what these five people did, like Deborah Meyer began in Harlem, and she created a school, a public school that was a small school, that really looked at inquiry and what she called habits of mind, is how do you tap the interest of children, no matter in what circumstances they are? And then how do you bring to life the idea that education isn't just something that goes on within four walls of a classroom or a school, but it is something that gives you power and influence in ways that you can contribute to a larger society? So Deborah Meyer, in time, she won the MacArthur Genius Award because she took that work with elementary schools, and then she created a secondary school. And then out of that, there were other schools that joined with her. And then after she had already retired for many years, she came back out because she just missed the joy of working in joyful places with children. And then way past the age of most people when they retire, she started a new school in Roxbury, Massachusetts. So I mean, she's one of the examples that goes along with all five of them. I mean, what they have in common is the basic idea that education has to tap the curiosity and interest of students. And where you get less of that are in schools that are either racially identified or economically identified as places that are, quote, at risk. And the way that policymakers deal with at risk is to push more and more requirements down that have to do with preparing students for a test. And so they take the life out of the school. They take the life out of what teachers aspire to be. And these people, the five in this book, have wonderful personal stories about the work they have done in schools, how it has affected them as human beings, what they have learned from others, and what are the real struggles in going counter to the conventions of what most people think schools should be.
Deborah Meyer said something interesting about the students she was working with. She started, I guess, as a substitute teacher in
a predominantly
black school, and it was supposedly a part-time job, but she just was so fascinated and so passionate about it that it became a completely full-time job that led to her life's passion. And one of the things she said that I thought was so interesting was that schools failed to work with the strengths that poor children had, namely their independence, their imagination, their resourcefulness. Instead of making use and building on those strengths, they just, you know, bored them to tears.
Yes, yes. And again, Deborah Meyer is, what Debbie is an example of, is when she first started to be a part-time teacher, because she had two young children, she needed to earn some money. She took on this as a substitute, long-term sub with, I believe, first graders in the book. And her professors, I believe at the University of Chicago, told her that she should get out of there, that she was too smart to be a teacher. And so that just infuriated her. She said there's no place that's more intellectually challenging than to be working with a group of students and trying to figure out what they're connecting to and what they're learning and how they're getting sidetracked. So what you see is this parallel through her whole life of making schools intellectually interesting places for the adults, where you can have great discussions about what should we be doing differently than we've done before. People can be bringing in their own hobbies, their own talents, and all focused around what's the best type of learning environment to provide for our students, and then how do we actually do it rather than just dream about it. I'll stop with Debbie, but the stories of each one of these five people, is the reason I think it's fascinating is because those who know these people professionally, they know them by their accomplishments. They don't know the human side of why they've stayed in this work. Several of them are in their 80s right now, and they're still at it. What is it that just triggers this satisfaction and commitment over this incredibly long span of time?
We're talking to Carl Glickman, editor of the book Those Who Dared, Five Visionaries Who Changed American Education. There's another link that is made that more than one of the people in the book makes, and that is the link between democracy, participation in the political system and political democracy on the one hand, and real success in education on the other hand. Those two things go together. When students start getting participatory, their test scores go up and their happiness and their sense of engagement in all levels of their education goes up. I found that fascinating.
Yeah, it's the same issue. I mean, it's the parallel issue with why do people get involved civically in their communities? Is if they don't think they have that anything's going to happen, or they're cynical, or they don't trust what kind of influence they could really have, they just withdraw. You know, they just withdraw. And it's the same thing with students who struggle in school. If they don't understand what they're learning, and they don't understand why their learning will make any greater difference in their lives, then they withdraw and they want to get out of school as quickly as they can turn that age where they no longer have to be there. So what all five of these people do very clearly is talk about a democracy in education are exactly the same. They're the same coin. They're two sides of the same coin. In that the reason we have public schools from its origins was it was supposed to provide an education for the public, which was to prepare them to use their learning in a way that would make a society better for all. And these five people have taken that notion really seriously about listening to students, students having voice, students being able to show their learning in expressive arts, as well as what we refer to the academic core in terms of music and theater. And so it's not, I mean, none of these people talk about schools as being free-for-alls where students go do whatever what they want to do. But what they talk about is schools where adults and children have a very close bonding relationship with each other, and students are pushed into worlds that they never could have imagined. And they can therefore see how what they're learning in school gives them so many more opportunities than they would ever would. No one would have ever have dreamed it. So that's a focus of these works about how do you bring democracy into the educational experience of students. And I'm not just talking about voting. I'm talking about in terms of how do we identify real problems and issues within our communities, and how do we use our science and our math and our communication and our reading to study and understand, and then being able to actually explore what could be done that could improve the quality of water or could do something in terms of giving back to older people who surround our school. There are just multiple ways where students in these schools learn that their education gives them power and gives them influence on something that's much greater than simply doing an assignment for a teacher or passing some standardized test that they're required to take.
One of the people in your book is James Comer, who was a psychiatrist, and
yes.
He worked in the schools, and it was there's a wonderful moment where he, you know, his mother had made a lot of sacrifices. He was an African-American man, and he became a doctor, and his mother had really supported him the whole way through, and then he goes back to his mother and tells her what he's doing, and his mother says, "Why, that's just common sense. They're paying you for that." What was the nature of his common sense approach?
Well, the nature of his common sense is that he had learned that if students are with adults who care for them, who are really interested in them as people, and treat them with respect and provide support, but also push students, that these relationships become all important in terms of what a student actually accomplishes. It's the support of the adults who enjoy what they're doing. They like being there. They know every student very well. They have control over making decisions about ways to educate these students. So, you know, the term's been bandied around a lot. It takes a village. But what Jim Comer found from his own experience in narrating this to his mother, how important these relationships are, is you can be the best technical teacher in the world in terms of knowledge and et cetera, but you're not going to tag the interests of a student who just doesn't have the same excitement about the content of what you're teaching. But if you're a teacher who really knows a child and understands, you know, the child's family and background, then you've got ways to relate to that student. So that student knows that when you're pushing me because you love me. You don't love me in the sense that everything is good, whatever I do. You love me in the sense that I can be so much better than I currently am. And so that's when his mother was saying, well, that's just common sense. And Jim Comer's point was, well, it may be common sense, but we make schools very, very depersonalized places, where students have a teacher with 25 other students, and if it's in a high school for only an hour, and then a bell rings and they go to somewhere else, and so teachers have 180, 200 kids a day.
Yeah, it's like factory work on the part of the teachers.
That's right. So students can learn with that type of those type of numbers and how anonymous it is. You can slide, you can just rest, or you can just wait it out. So the only one other thing I want to say about Jim Comer is the images that people have that they carry with them through their whole lives. So Jim Comer grew up in an African-American community, not well-to-do. When he was graduating from high school, his two closest friends, who were just as smart and competent as he was, he said goodbye to them the last night before he went to college. And he explains it. He said, this is the image I've carried through my whole life and why I went from being a medical doctor to getting an issue into education. Is because when I looked at my friends and my friends looked at me the evening before, we all had tears in our eyes because we knew that I was going one way and they were going another way. And one of his friends committed suicide. The other one got involved in high-risk drugs and died an early age. And that image always haunted him about what is it that really smart, curious individuals, what is it that keeps them from their promise? And that's why he has dedicated his whole life to work in urban and poverty, high poverty place, on the same issues that if you're well-to-do. It's the idea that you're with adults who think that you're somebody and that they will find the kind of support and resources that you need, even if it extends beyond school itself.
I mean, I think he made a couple of very interesting points and sort of discoveries in his work, and one of them was that a school is more than the sum of its parts. It's not just students and teachers and staff all working together, but it's a system, and when you understand it as a system, you can really improve education.
Well, if you understand the influences that go around the learning of a child, then all these influences, if you look at how they can work together rather than apart, then you automatically know that if a child has a toothache and they don't have any way to get dental care, then in the morning when they haven't slept all night and they can hardly keep their eyes open as class begins, they're not going to learn as sufficiently as a student who had their teeth taken care of. So that's where his medical, that's where his, the whole idea around health, the idea around that there are lots and lots of services that are vital to children that are critical to how well they learn, and they don't all reside in the school. Parenting is another issue. Around, you can't ignore the education that's provided in a home. And there's a way you can support parents and family education. So he doesn't have like a logarithm that says, you know, you need to do this, this, and this, and this. What he's saying is the power of a school is to be the center of a community for a child. And that has an influence inside and outside the school in how do you have them work together.
We're talking to Carl Glickman, editor of the book, Those Who Dared, Five Visionaries Who Changed American Education. One of the people in your book is John Goodlad, who was an advocate for ungraded schools. Why ungraded schools?
Well, ungraded schools because I'm laughing because the whole concept of graded came from Prussia in the 19th century. It was a way to sort and classify and keep students like widgets moving along a line. Nowhere else are children and adults separated because you're 5 years old or you're 11 or you're 16. I mean, grades are just an artificial way of sorting and grouping students. In the real world, you don't just work with somebody your same age. You work across all kinds of ages. And so what's happened historically is we develop these schools based on a management model of a factory to make it more efficient to move students along and figure out who's in what level, et cetera. And then we treat teachers as the managers of the assembly line. And what John Goodlad says, that's artificial. That's not the way that adults work. That's not the way that children should work. Children should be working on the curriculum and the academic interests that they have, and they should not be separated from students who are older than them or younger than them, because like an 8-year-old may know more about some kind of music composition than an 11-year-old does. And by them being in the same classroom, they can learn things from each other that they would not have learned if they were just all identified as you are a fourth grader, which means you're either 8 or 9 years old. But the, you know, without belaboring it, what's also typical about all of these giants I refer to is you have to prepare students for life today and life in the future. And the more that they work, the more they see adults working in their own natural settings, and the more they see that school is a way to participate in this adult work, then what they learn not only has meaning to them, but that they are pushed in much harder ways than to know you've got a particular assignment and you have to fill these out and have these back within 20 minutes. So, John, good lads, the ungraded school is simply when you see kids in the playground by themselves, they're not in first, second, or third grade. They're just children out there on the playground playing together.
There's another thing that's very striking in the book, which is just how hard it is to make long-term changes in education as schools are decentralized and leadership changes so often. And there are some rather sad examples in which years of progress are undone in a single instant when there's a change of leadership or a school board or an individual who's hostile to a new program. These are five visionaries in your book who really changed education. What is the effect of those changes that you can really see?
Well, there are some schools that have been at this work with any one of these individuals for 20, 25 years. I just came back from a meeting last weekend with some high schools that have been part of what is called the Coalition of Essential Schools, which are students' learning is all performance-based rather than multiple-choice-based. And these schools still thrive. But the problem with American education is that we are too dependent on individuals. So what happens is reform efforts in a lot of schools, because there is such a hierarchy of authority and control at levels above teachers, is what happens is if you switch out those people who are in greater control, they want to put their own stamp on what the school is, and therefore, in doing so, they often disregard the changes and the positive practices that have occurred, and then they want to put their own stamp. So when you have a system that's based on hierarchy and control, is that when you change the controllers, you often change the practices of the school. And that's an issue that is critical to a democracy, because a democracy shouldn't be predicated on the authority of an individual. Democracy should be predicated on people developing a common future with each other by thinking through what the issues are of today and what are we going to do about it tomorrow. And our schools are should be the laboratories of democracy for our children.
Are there other places that have a different model that works better?
Oh, I think so. I don't think there's one model. I mean, every one of these five in this book, each one, their schools are vary in some ways. I mean, they're alike in the sense that there's interest, curiosity, liveliness. Faculty want to be there in these schools. Parents experience what the excitement of the student when they come home. And students, I think what's parallel in all these schools is students learn that learning is real. When you read, you're not just reading for somebody. You're reading so you understand something that you didn't experience before. So those are commonalities. But the essential commonality is that they put a lot of decision-making on the teachers, the staff, the parents, and the students in the school to have greater flexibility and common authority to make educational decisions as to what's the best way to assess a student. In our curriculum, should we link math and science in some combination? Should we have certain times where we have a particular type of theater performance that identifies the school to its neighborhood? So in other words, the schools don't look alike in terms of the activities that students are involved in. The curriculum doesn't exactly look alike because they trust that educated people will make better educational decisions than what someone else from away from the school would tell them what to do. So in that sense, they're not, you know, they do look different on purpose because schools are in different communities. There's different kinds of problems and possibilities. And it's the idea of democracy in practice where the educators and the parents and the staff and students raise the essential question is, what do we want our children to look like when they leave us? And then how do we build a curriculum around that?
And there's a real distaste that a number of the writers in your book have for standardized testing and for No Child Left Behind.
Yes, yes. Well, the distaste is multiple. I mean, it's a multiple distaste. But the promise of No Child Left Behind is to reduce the achievement gap in America, you know, among poor, around ethnicity, race, gender, language, et cetera, et cetera. And so the promise of that, the preamble to that is wonderful. I mean, that's exactly the way it should be. The same way the Declaration of Independence is as a preamble is really wonderful, and that's exactly the way it should be. But the problem is in the top-down directives and the requirements that schools have no flexibility on that judges whether or not they're being successful. And so what these visionaries have in common is learning is much broader than taking a single standardized test that then boils down to a number that then identifies how much someone has learned. And the reason that they rage against this is it diminishes so much of what students could learn. Because what you have is in schools where students tend to be poor, they tend not to score high on these tests that are required. What happens is all the expressive parts of the curriculum get thrown out. Music gets reduced. Art gets reduced. Physical education gets reduced. Social science inquiry gets reduced. No field trips. Recess gets cut. And the predominant time is spent preparing kids for a test. And the test is not that significant. The test makers themselves, on the first page of their instructions, say themselves that this test should not be used as a single measure of what a student learns. But the reality is, it is the single measure that's used to judge the school and to judge the performance and to punish the school or to reward the school. So what it does is it boils education down to a lot of test drilling with kids who academically don't make quick connections anyhow to how important learning should be, and then that type of drill down locks everybody up. So the kids are sick of preparing for the test. Teachers are sick of having to teach kids to the test. And they know that the other forms of learning that are actually more important to a child's life, they can't get around to. So that's really the sadness. Now, the counter to this is many of the schools that these visionaries have worked with have fought hard to get some variance or waivers or charter school status so that they're not so straitjacket. But it's been a tough, tough battle. But those schools that have gotten waivers and they've used other forms of assessments have had astounding success of looking at their students as graduate and what they're doing 3 or 4 years later.
I mean, there's amazing stories of just completely closing the gap between poor black schools and affluent white schools. The kids
yes.
who have a chance, just, they do exactly the same as their wealthier counterparts.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, there's schools in urban New York City that 90% of all their kids go on to college. They live healthy lives. They are community leaders. And these are schools that show the power of when you put thoughtful people together who understand the public purpose of education, and they won't settle for what other people tell them to do. So, yes, there's examples, but you can also pick up in the different stories that these writers write about, you can pick up the frustration, because they know, even though there's thousands of schools in this country that are not just pockets of hope, they also have a research base in terms of what has happened to students who have graduated from their schools. And the frustration is that this should be the type of education for all students, whether you're poor or wealthy. This is, in fact, a quality education. And so it's fighting against people so far removed from the school who set all the requirements with no acknowledgement that there's something more important to an education of a student than a single test. Now, I don't want to go too long on this. None of them are against kids being tested on a standardized test. What they're against is that being the sole measure of what a student has learned.
Carl Glickman is the editor of the book, Those Who Dared, Five Visionaries Who Changed American Education. I want to thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Well, I want to thank you very, very much. I mean, I really enjoyed your questions. They were penetrating and insightful, and they really picked me up and made me think.
Well, thank you. Excellent. Well, we're going to take a little break right now, and we'll be right back. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Shelley Hirsch. She is a vocalist, composer, and interdisciplinary artist. She's in Santa Fe this week teaching classes at the Center for Contemporary Arts, and she will be performing this Sunday, November 23rd at 7 o'clock at Santa Fe Complex. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. And Red Sell is here. He is the founder, director, and I guess curator of The Process, which is a nonprofit organization that brings people like Shelley to Santa Fe.
Exactly. We try to promote unusual and important artists from around the globe.
So, Shelley, let's talk about your work. First of all, how did you begin performing?
Oh, it started out when I was a young kid, like just being inspired by everything and putting on little shows in the hallways of the apartment building where I grew up, and it just continued from there. It was very organic.
Was it first and foremost about singing, which is part of what you do, but also it's very much about performance and storytelling?
Yes, but it's all from the voice and kind of generated from the body, which kind of synthesizes every idea and every experience I have. And you know, all the listening that I did as a little kid. And
what were you listening to as a little kid?
Well, I was listening to, at that time, Frank Sinatra and Nat King Cole and Ema Sumac and Montavani Strings and Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin and just music from everything I could get my hands on. But it started out, of course, with my parents playing the record player at that time. In the enchanted living room, because music made everything very alive for me.
And so then, I am assuming that probably the late 60s, early to mid 70s, you got into a scene, what, in New York City?
I would say early 70s, I actually lived in Europe in the early 70s, and then mid 70s, I start getting How about that sound? Okay, I started getting more involved in the scene in New York, more like the end of the 70s and the early 80s.
So what were your inspirations in Europe and then in New York? Like, what was happening for you?
I wanted to become a kabuki dancer because I was always looking for forms that incorporated visual art and sound and some kind of storytelling and movement. And then I joined a theater group in California. And that's where I learned that men, not women, play all the parts.
Right.
So I wound up joining an experimental theater company, and that led to somehow finding this group in Europe. Lots of crazy connections, and a lot of the work is about following all of these crazy connections. And then I wound up singing swing in a band in Amsterdam, and
like straight ahead swing dancing, kind of
not swing dancing,
40,
but
yes, 40s.
With a swing band, and I always loved songs, but then I always experimented with sound, natural sounds also, like birds, and we'd go to these landscapes when I was in the theater group and kind of try to recreate it in the rehearsal space, bringing in a lot of the environment.
And so, I mean, at that time, there was a tremendous breaking away from traditional theater and involving the audience in certain ways and a kind of freedom and wildness. What was that like, both experientially and philosophically, for you?
Well, I hope that that's still what's going on now with me, but I guess at that time, a lot of the work really concentrated on finding new ways to interact with the audience. But I remember being a little kid and putting on these pieces in the hallway, and I would have the audience stand at the stairwells as we were going down the staircase in a procession. So, I don't know, a lot of these ideas started as just being a young kid fascinated with sound and the environment where I was and the kind of melting pot, and it just continued and continued. And yes, theater at that time really was such an incredible melding of so many things. And
so what are you teaching this week here in Santa Fe?
I'm going to base it on what I see from the people that come there, but they'll be given, we'll work on just doing sound, and then we'll take words and see where that goes, how to locate things in the body, you know, like find ways of making different sounds and maybe reading things and speaking them differently, seeing what happens when you talk like that in another language. All of a sudden you might actually think a different way. So yes. No, I don't want to sing more than that.
Why don't we hear a little bit of your music right now and come back in just a moment.
Sure.
I wanted to be a kabuki dancer when I was young. Very young. I mean it. I love masks. I didn't know there were men behind there. I wanted to be a woman doing it.
And there was stones put together in the rock garden by the temple of what I loved, with the trees hanging over red maple. The smell of cedar went right through my bones. I could not believe what I smelled. I could not bear to see the streets filled with all those people. Though I loved the little packages in the store, we walked up to the hill. There were thousands and thousands of people. We walked up to the temple, and the temple was like an
but far from a distance. One light lit by electricity shone upon some kind of beautiful pagoda-like temple that looked like some outer space object set inside those trees that I'd been looking at from close. Now they were far away, and I thought all those people praying they believed what they were doing, and I believed I was in a certain place that I had thought would end. Possibilities, so many possibilities, and sometimes you go so many places. It's so nice, the simple things. Come back home, have a cup of coffee in your favorite place, read the newspaper, understand every word.
And we've been listening to music of Shelley Hirsch. Tell us about this piece.
Well, this person, Uchihashi Kazuhisa, has a festival in Japan. Actually, it was in Kobe. And he invited me to come over to the festival and play, and then we were going to do a duo tour together. We'd never played a note together. So during the festival, we did a trio improv with a classical pianist, and then we had this gig. We'd never played duo together, and he recorded it and released it on CD, and it was a very funny experience. The club was called the Big Apple, and it was tiny. And so it was
and
the
Japan.
Audience. Yeah, and it was in Japan. It was very funny, but it just, I don't know, we just really connected. It was wonderful.
It must be amazing when that kind of magic happens with somebody you've never played with before.
Love it. It's one of the amazing perks of the job. You know, it's like meeting a wonderful person that suddenly, you know, you've never met them before, and you just have this incredible conversation that can go places that you've never experienced before so easily.
Right.
So it was wonderful.
Red Cell is the founder and curator of The Process, which is the nonprofit group that's bringing Shelley and many others here to Santa Fe. Shelley Hirsch, by the way, is performing this Sunday, the 23rd of November at 7 o'clock at Santa Fe Complex. How did you start doing all of this? You're a music person, I guess.
Yes, I have a long history of working in music stores over the last 17 years. And I moved here to Santa Fe about 4.5 years ago, and started hanging out with the High Mayhem crowd, and it was their interest that kept me here for quite a while. And then I started thinking about doing my own things, and a good friend of mine, Rio in Medio, lives here in town, and she's had some pretty successful history in the music industry, and she had a friend coming from France, and was asking, is there anywhere for her to play? And we couldn't think of anything. So I said, let's just do it at my house. And hence the process was born. And we've had people from all over the globe come and play. We try to find unusual or important but overlooked things that don't usually come to Santa Fe and bring them here.
And people different like kinds Shelley. Of music.
Everything. There's nothing that we're opposed to. We also try to use other interdisciplinary arts. And we'll show films. We have a film on William S. Burroughs coming that's never been played in the U.S. before.
You're kidding.
We will.
And a film on Burroughs that's never been played in the U.S.?
It's brand new.
Oh, okay.
It's coming from Denmark. And there's a whole lot of things like that in the works. So it's not just music, although most of what we do is music. Gertrude Stein was a big influence for us. The salons that she did, where she would basically ask her friends to perform for each other whenever they were staying at her house. And I liked that idea a lot, because I like being around interesting people. So
Shelley, how has your work changed and evolved since the 70s when you were really creating the kind of thing that you do now? It seems like the whole concept of the avant-garde and what's experimental has really changed since then. Or maybe not so much. I don't know.
I don't know. I think that I've always followed, just tried to really explore things in an authentic way. That was important for me. That I always felt really, truly experienced somehow. And as kooky and far out as it was, it had to be really viscerally connected and also connect to people. Like a lot of times I'll do things and really just hone in on someone in the audience and bring that into it. So
how do they feel about that?
Well, the other day I did a concert in New York, and it was, they love it, sure. And sometimes I've worried that if I'm talking about one person, like I was telling the story about one person the other day as I was singing, and I asked afterwards, how do you feel hearing these personal stories about people? And just because, maybe because it's just so connected and authentic, and maybe, I don't know, maybe because I can do it so well, or when it's intrinsically connected to the music, which I kind of ride on like some magic carpet, people just get into it.
Now, do you always play with a band or with musicians?
No. I do very different things. Like the other day was just, I decided to do something with a friend that was, who I've played with since 1982, and it was going to be a crazy kaleidoscopic quilt of our collective musical mutual memory. So anything that had been in any of our other pieces could come up. But then suddenly I would look at somebody in the audience and weave that into it. And so, but I do things. I'm going to be playing with J.A. Dean, and I first played with him in, I guess, 1981, when the time he was in a band called Indoor Life that came to New York, and I said, and I was playing in a new wave-ish band then, or punky, new wavy jazz band, and I said, hey, why doesn't your band rehearse in my loft, you know? And then he and I started to play together, and actually we're going to be playing with Butch Morris in Europe coming up soon, but this opportunity for when Red Cell asked me to come here, I said, hey, Dino's living here. This is a great opportunity to have a reunion with him. So
this will be this is the Sunday evening concert.
Yes, but I also do things with soundtracks, or I compose my own pieces, but I've been working with the music of Bernard Herrmann. So what I do is I take a lot of the soundtracks from films that he wrote music for. I don't do Psycho, but that's what he's mostly known for. Fahrenheit 451, The Day the Earth Stood Still. And I will kind of try to immerse myself in this beautiful orchestral sound on tape, and kind of draw images from the films, from the memory, my memory of the films, and then weave these little stories that also then connect to my own stories, or then might actually talk about, ooh, listen to that trombone, you know, I imagine sitting on the whatever. So I might then reflect on the instrumentation. I like exploring things from different angles. So I like totally being very, very inside of a sound and then suddenly coming out and looking at it from an observer's point of view, from an outside point of view.
Which is the kind of thing you'll be doing at the CCA.
Very much, yes. Yes.
Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday from 6 to 9, Shelley will be teaching some voice classes at the CCA.
And the number over there is 982-1338. And Red Cell is founder and curator of The Process, which is a nonprofit group that can be found on the web at...
Our Facebook site, just type in The Process in Santa Fe or MySpace. Same thing, The Process in Santa Fe, and we'll come right up.
Red Cell, thanks so much for being here. And Shelley Hirsch, vocalist, composer, and interdisciplinary artist, who will be at the Santa Fe Complex this Sunday, November 23rd at 7 o'clock. The address over there is 624 Agua Fria Street, and they are on the web at sfcomplex.org, and the number is 216-7562. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
Sure. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz with John Greenspan presents the monthly New Orleans Hour. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We will see you tomorrow. Ciao.